Hebrews chapter 1, which we just started last week. Not that long ago, most of you probably know, I had the chance to go to Africa. And in going, we took different jets. We went from here to London, from London then to Ghana. And then when our trip was over, we went from Ghana back to London. And when I got there, I got to do something I've never done before. I got the opportunity to ride on an Airbus 787. I think that's what it is. No, it's an Airbus 380. The 700s, that's the Boeing jets. Airbus 380, and they call it the Dreamliner. Now, I don't know if you've ever been on one, but let me tell you, that thing is appropriately named. It is incredible. It is one massive jet, and the entire length of the jet is a double-decker. You know, the 747 has those that just in the front section where it's two stories. This one's two-story throughout. And when you get in that jet, not only do you get the new plane smell, but you've got all kinds of room. It's spacious. It's wonderful. It's nice. And, you know, and as I got ready to go on that, if I not only got excited about what I was going to ride, I was also excited about my destination because I was finally going to get to go home where I get to see my own wife, my family. I would get to sleep in my own bed. I would actually get to take a shower. That was a wonderful thing to look forward to as well. But in order to do so, something had to happen. I had to get on that jet. I had to trust that Airbus had built those wing spars that were strong and sturdy enough that they were going to hold those wings up and keep that fuselage connected to it and hold those engines on to it, that those spars were going to take care of all of our weight. And let's face it, where all the real weight is, everybody's carry-on luggage, that it was going to be able to hold and suspend that as well. I had to put a trust in Airbus that they knew what they were doing when they built that thing. And I had to put a trust in Rolls-Royce that the engines that they built and suspended on that jet had enough thrust that they were going to take this thing and they were going to move it forward down the runway and keep it moving forward across the Atlantic. And then I also had to trust in British Airways that they had trained their crews to be able to not only navigate and fly that jet to its destination, but that they would be able to handle any sort of unexpected things or incidents or even emergencies that might occur. There was a lot of trust that I was exerting the minute I stepped onto that jet. Now imagine, if you will, for a minute, that you were with me on this flight. You've gone with me across the ocean to London and then down to Accra. You've flown with me from Accra back to London. But as soon as we get to London, I look at that Airbus and I go, I'm not doing it. What do you mean you're not doing it, Jack? I'm not doing it. I'm not getting on an Airbus. I'm getting on a Greyhound bus. And I'm going to ride that bus to the shore. And then when I get to the shore, I'm going to buy myself a ticket and I'm going to get on a boat and I'm going to sail my way across and back. Now, what would you say to me? You all know what you would be thinking. You'd be going, oh, wait a minute, Jack. You started flying. You went those other three legs. You're not going to finish the fourth leg on the jet. You're going to forsake the convenience and the speed and the food. Maybe not the food. But you're going to forsake the speed and the convenience and even, yes, the comfort and all the amenities that are going to go with flying to go on a ship. And on a bus? Are you kidding me? That's what you would say. And you would be right to say it. You would say, you started towards this destination one way, why won't you finish it in the same way? And that is exactly what the writer of Hebrews is dealing with, spiritually speaking, with a number of Jewish Christians. You've got a number of people who have come to the Dreamliner. His name is Jesus Christ. And they started on the journey. They got on board and they were flying and going along just fine. But now all of a sudden they're starting to trade some things for a Greyhound bus instead of an Airbus. And so principally they knew about Jesus, but practically they were in grave danger of starting to go backwards and starting to trust and believe and put their confidence and faith in other things. Things that weren't as good. And so the writer of Hebrews starts out by giving them a call to basically say, you need to finish the way you began. Don't give up and don't quit. By trusting in Jesus Christ, you need to leave behind the old ways, the things that were a shadow of Christ, and instead go to your destination, which is maturity in Jesus Christ. Now, if you had to write this book, how would you do it? What would you call people to do? Chances are you would do exactly what this writer did. You would begin to point them towards the object of their faith, and you would begin to show them all of his glories, all of the reasons they trusted him to begin with, and remind them of how he really is exceedingly more and better than anything else that they could imagine. What Hebrews ultimately seeks to do is to show Jesus Christ is infinitely qualified, not only to reveal to us God's plan, but to personally provide everything we need for growth and maturity. That's what the book is doing. And the author is not going to let these people start going backwards. He won't do it. Now I want to take just a minute before we look at this, just to kind of give you a broad overview of where this book is going to go. First of all, the theme of it is press on. Press on to maturity in Jesus Christ. That's the application based upon the exhortation. And the method, how's he going to do it? Well, the author is going to go back to pointing the object of their faith. And he's going to show them the superiority of Jesus Christ, and he's going to do it in four ways. The first way is he's going to say, I'm going to show you how Jesus Christ is superior in his person. And the second thing I'm going to do is show you how Jesus Christ is superior in his priesthood. Now, that won't happen until about chapters 4 and 5 on through about chapter 10. Starting around chapters 10 through 12, he's going to show the superiority of Christ and the principle of faith. And then he's going to wrap it up, some of 12 and most of 13, by saying Jesus Christ is superior in the practice of your faith. So for now, we're just going to be going through, and for the next few weeks, we're going to be going through just the very first principle there. And I made sure to include that on the little handout that I gave you there in your bulletin, so you can sort of remember that. We're dealing with the person of Jesus Christ, the only Son of God. And the first four verses of chapter 1 that start this. We began, you know, 1.5 verses last week, but the first four of them, I almost see them a little bit like a table of contents. It's giving you sort of, here's everything we're going to cover and everything I'm going to highlight to you, but I'm condensing it in a very short form. And I'm going to show you how Jesus is superior. And later we're going to see the comparison, how Jesus is superior to the angels, how he is superior to Moses, to the law, to the temple, to the priesthood, and Aaron. And all of that, the later chapters are going to expound upon and go a lot more in depth and look at some Old Testament scripture to show us. But ultimately, the call is, as we're teaching these things, don't you go backwards. Don't you do it. Get on the Dreamliner. Don't shortchange yourself and get on that bus. And today, what I have is I have a very unique privilege, I think. This kind of sermon may be one of the easiest of all, because all I have to do is take Jesus and like a gym, all I got to do is hold him up and just turn him like this. And then all I got to say, see that? And you all go, whoa. Almost don't even have to say anything. Then I turn him a little bit. Now look at him from here. Whoa. This is what these verses do. They hold him up. And go back to Genesis 1. You've got creation. 7 days, you know, 6 days of creation and then a rest, but you've got these 7 days all showing us different things about the character of God. I'm going to show you through these verses 7 different aspects as to the superiority of Jesus Christ and why he's the Dreamliner. And then we're going to look at it sort of through Jewish eyes, and then we're going to look at it through our eyes today and say, okay, now why is that significant for us? And explore it, all right? So are you with me? I know some of you stayed up late and you watched that football game. It was terrible, you know. Get that out, you know. Stay alert. Stay with me. We've got some coffee in the back if you need it, but hang in there with me. So let's start here, and I'm just going to repeat a little bit of what we looked at from last week. Let's start again in verse 1 of chapter 1. It says, after God spoke long ago in various portions and in various ways to our ancestors through the prophets, well, in these last days, he has spoken to us in a son, whom he appointed heir of all things. The Son is superior because God has chosen him to be his heir. If someone is heir to something, the things that they inherit, they now have an authority over. If you have a relative who passes away, you're the heir to their goods, their money, their possessions, everything else is now yours to begin to decide what to do with. But it becomes your property, and now you are responsible for it. And what we find is that Jesus Christ is the heir according to all that God has and is entrusted now completely unto him. A good word, a good synonym for you note takers, maybe to put in your Bible as to why this is significant, put down the word authority. The heir is the one who has authority, and Jesus has superiority over all these other things because he has the ultimate authority. Great Old Testament picture of this. Y'all remember Jacob? Jacob had his sons, and he had his one son who was his favorite, Joseph, and he bought him a coat of many colors. Took that coat and put it on his son, and all the other brothers disdained him. And you know why? Because of what that coat signified. It signified, this one is going to be my heir. This one is going to get all that I have, and I'm marking him out from the beginning. And the brothers knew that. That's why they hated him so bad. He was his Joseph's authority was going to go right over them. Well, Jesus has inherited all authority. And for these Hebrews, it seems that along the way they had forgotten that. And I don't know, maybe they were looking at, you know, an aspect of the angels and the angels and the giving of the law unto Moses, and they were sort of the mediator that God would use. And maybe they had this elevated view of what these angels were like. And angels are important, and they're very spiritual beings. And maybe there was a falling back to seeing them as being more significant, or turning to them, or trusting something to them. But what this writer is highlighting to us up front, none of those angels was ever an heir. None of them got that. None of them are superior. You mean to tell me that God has entrusted all authority to the Son, but you would go for angels? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You'd do that? Well, the rest of chapter 1, he's going to go a lot more in depth onto that. And so instead of belaboring it today, which means I wouldn't have anything to talk about next week, I'm going to save it for next week. And so let's us continue. Let's take that gem of Jesus and turn him a little bit and look at a different angle, another way that he is superior. It comes in the latter part of verse 2. It says, and through whom he created the world. So this son, this revelation that God has given is better in every way because he was the creator. Jack, you mean to tell me when I go back in Genesis chapter 1 and I start reading about God creating, you're telling me that that was Jesus Christ? That's exactly what I'm telling you. Colossians also helps to confirm this for us, that he has always existed and he could speak the worlds into the creation merely by his mouth. Why is that significant? Here's another word you can put down for this. It means he is sovereign. This Jesus is sovereign. Angels, yeah, they might have had some power. They do have some power and some majesty. They had all kinds of stuff about them that would sort of floor us and make us almost fall on our faces. But none of them have sovereignty. Not a single one. So the writer can say, you mean you like these angels? Over the one who has all sovereignty, who could speak, who could even create the angels? Are you kidding me? No, he is superior. Third aspect comes out of verse 3. He continues, the Son is the radiance of his glory. So Jesus is superior because the glory of God itself radiates and comes from him. Now, if you remember your Old Testament, there was a character in the Old Testament of whom the glory of God radiated from for just a little while. You remember that? It was Moses. Moses went up on the mountain, he spent time with God, and when he came down, it said his face shone such that he had to put a veil over his face so the Israelites couldn't look at him. The only problem with that was it was a reflected radiance. That was not something that came from Moses. It was something that just sort of bounced off of him. It's a comparison almost like between the sun and the moon. If you're looking for energy, which do you go to, the sun or the moon? Well, obviously you go to the sun. All the moon does is reflect what the sun has given, and that light bounces off. But the sun itself emits that light and that energy. In fact, you would say this, you cannot really divorce the light that comes from the sun from the Son. You would almost say that Son, I mean, they're one and the same. There's a oneness to them. And this writer is saying, when you're talking about the glory of God that comes off of Jesus, it's the same thing that comes from God. Now that is a powerful statement. We're not dealing with somebody who's a prophet. We're not dealing with somebody who's an angel. We're dealing with somebody who is God Himself. And so there is a glory of God that radiates from this one. Why is that important? That's important for this reason. It tells you that He is the eternal one. The same glory that comes out of God is the same glory that comes from this one. He is the eternal one. And you cannot separate His glory from God's. And to a Jewish people who are reading this, now stop and think about this for a minute where they were, because often, in fact, for centuries, they found the glory in the temple. That was sort of the showing of who God was. In fact, within their Old Testament, it was the glory of God that came down and sometimes would reside in the temple. And as they're looking back and remembering this, they would say, well, the temple was grand and marvelous and it's glorious. And Herod's temple certainly fit that in Jerusalem. It was a majestic sight. I mean, its size, the gold in it, the colors that emanated from it, the architecture that you would have seen in it, it was meant to reflect a glory of God. But that glory did not emanate from it. It didn't come from it. The temple was never a source of glory. So, Hebrews, would you look to a temple to discover the glory of God? Or would you go to the very God whom that glory emanates from? What? The temple? Are you kidding me? No, Jesus is superior. He is superior because He has that authority, the sovereignty. He is the eternal one. And now we'll get to another point. Verse 3. Jesus is the representation of God's essence. If you had a coin, that coin usually would have an image. Our coins do the same thing. You've got an image on it. And that stamp comes because you have a die that hits that metal, makes the impression, comes off, and whatever's on the die, you now have that image here. And in verse 1, one of the things that the writer has written is that Jesus Christ is the final word. And here we find He's not only the final word, He is the full and perfect revelation of God. The full and perfect one. So you take a Roman coin and on it you would find the image of the emperor on that little coin, impressed by the die that stamped the image. And you see the coin, you see the emperor. I decided to bring a little coin here. This is something most of you have seen. It's a silver dollar, though it's not real silver. This is an Eisenhower silver dollar. And on there you've got the image, the impression of Eisenhower. It was put there by a die, stamped it right in there. Now if we lost the die, one of the things we know is we got this. We know what He looks like. His image is there and it's perfect. Well, in the same way, Jesus is the stamp of God. You see Jesus, you have seen God. Now, for a Jew, where did they go with this? The closest thing, the best thing that they probably had with this was the priesthood. And a lot of times they would look to that. That's where you were going to see holiness. And maybe an aspect of what God was like. They were meant to see the priests were dressed different, that there was a color and a glory and a majesty that went with that, but there was also their service that they did, their handling, their treatment of the law and of the sacrifices. All these different aspects were to show them the holiness of God, even their service that they would do in the temple. And yet, how good were they? How close did they represent God? Well, let me give you an example. Let's go all the way back once again, deep into your Old Testament, when Moses went up on the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments. You remember a guy named Aaron, who's down there with the people? This is the first high priest, and the people coax him, and he takes all their golden jewelry, he melts it down, and he builds a golden calf. The high priest was the very first idolater. Pretty incredible. And the writer of Hebrews could look at them and say, no, wait a minute. Are you going to look to things like that to show you the image, the representation of God, when you've got Jesus, the exact representation? Are you kidding me? There's no choice. No choice at all. Verse 3, the fifth way that Jesus is superior. It says, and he sustains all things by his powerful word. That means in the highest realms, whether you're talking the cosmos and the planets and the galaxies and so forth and what's going on there, or you break it down to the most microscopic level, the atomic and molecular level, Jesus Christ is over and sustaining every bit of it. And he's not just sustaining it in terms of now, he always has and he always wills. The word here of sustain also implies a time aspect, not just an extent. In fact, the word to sustain means to bear along. A great example of this, you remember when Israel was in the desert? One of the things we learn is that God sustained them through the desert. He saw to their care. He allowed certain things to come into their path, and he delivered them from those things that threatened them. But he bore them along. Why is that significant? Because it reminds us of this, that Jesus Christ is in complete command and control. He is in complete command and control. And he is exercising his will to a predetermined end. He's not only overseeing the present, he is the God of prophecy, and he is going to see that his prophecy is fulfilled and completed and done. So he's the Lord of history as well as the Lord of prophecy. And he directs it where he ultimately wills. And I know for a fact, I am not the only one who looks around at our nation and at our world today and sees things and asks, do things not seem more crazy than ever, particularly within our nation, and how things are so upside down and topsy-turvy? And yet, this is a direction that is not outside the scope and the control of our God. And one of the things I've learned is if I see these plates spinning and they're going all sorts of directions, I got to remember something. He's sustaining them in their spin. And he has an ends that he's working towards. What about a Jew? What might he look to try to find some sort of confidence in, to see maybe some representation of God's command and authority? You know, one of the places that he could look would have been God's temple again. Because again, it's grand and it's glorious. And in most people's cases, it was there before they lived, and it was probably going to be there after they died. There was this ongoing aspect to it, and yet it was still very much subject to time. Temple itself is subject to wear and tear. And so ultimately, there is no control, no command in and through that. But if Jesus is in command and control for all time, this writer could say, why would you go back to something like the temple? Why would you do that? Are you kidding me? Oh, he's superior. Next way he's superior. The writer says, and so when he had accomplished cleansing for sins. Now you know why that's important. You can put down the word sacrifice. And notice that it says he had accomplished. That means it's past tense. This is something that has been done. This is why it was so important on the cross that we needed to hear him say, it is finished. He's done. The sacrifice has been complete. Before temple sacrifices, what'd you do? Well, some of y'all were here when we went through Leviticus. You know, what was it, a year and a half ago? And you remember how the mundaneness and the routine? Every Sunday we looked at these different sacrifices and how over and over again people would bring a bull, a lamb, a goat, a bird. You brought these things and you brought them again and you brought them again and you brought them again and you had them sacrificed. And now the writer's reminding us, but the sacrifice is done. And you don't have to keep bringing your bulls and your goats and your birds and everything else. It is finished. When you go back and you look in the temple, some of you, if you've done a study of the temple, you know there's different pieces of furniture that were in it, right? You got a table over here, you got a lampstand, you got this big basin for water just outside. All these different things. But you know one thing that you never found in the temple? It was a couch. There was no couch because the priest was not supposed to sit. And the reason he wouldn't sit is because sin is constantly going on in the camp. And so the sacrifices have to constantly be given. It's why, maybe you didn't realize this, the priest had to retire at 50 years of age. Why? Because he's wore out. Rode hard and hung up wet, is what we say in Texas. I mean, he's spent because of all that he's had to do. And the writer's coming back to us and saying, and you want to go back to that? Are you kidding me? No way. No way. And in a small way, that leads us into the final point that the writer makes. The seventh reason Jesus is superior. It says, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. The word you can put there is honor. That's why that's significant. Honor. And he sits in the place. He can sit because the work is done. But he's not just in any position. He's in the position where God has exalted and recognized him. Now, for a Jew, they might look to the priest, you know, to say, well, that's a pretty honorable position. Once again, they're clothed pretty incredibly and pretty amazingly. They have some unique privileges and unique responsibilities. But no priest ever got a seat or position like this. In fact, no angel ever got a seat or a position like this. None of them. I come back to the way I started. Jesus is the dreamliner. He is. He's the best there is. And with this kind of an intro, now look where the author goes. Verse 4. And thus, having taken into account everything we just talked about, he became so far better than the angels as he has inherited a name superior to theirs. It's like he starts over again. He goes back to heir. He goes back to inheritance. And the rest of the chapter, he's going to expound upon this, why Jesus is so much greater than the angels. And as I mentioned before, we'll pick up there next week. But for now, we're going to stop and just kind of bring this home for ourselves. Because up to this point, I've given you a lot of instances, a lot of reasons why this would have been important for a Jew, a Hebrew Christian. And you can kind of see that and see how it applies fairly easily. The question then becomes, well, how does it apply to us? Because last time I checked, I wasn't really called to go to Jerusalem and start sacrificing, you know, in the temple, and not really drawn into the priesthood and these various things that they had to combat. So how does this really apply to us? Well, there's another aspect here, too, than the way that this would have applied. I mean, the big picture is this idea of going back to other things that you put your faith and your trust in. It's not finishing the way you started. And there's a lot of reasons why they would have done this. I mean, on the one hand, they were tired. They became believers, and, you know, that brought some difficulties for them. And there was some persecution that they had to go through, and for a lot of them, becoming a Christian meant it brought on a whole lot of new problems. And I'm sure many of them came to faith believing what a lot of times many of you believe when you come to faith, that if I become like a Christian, or if I become a Christian, it's going to be a lot like listening to country and Western music backwards. You know what I mean when I say that? When you listen to country and Western music, it's all about what you lost, your wife, your truck, your dog. But if you play it backwards, you get all that stuff back. Well, in some ways, a lot of people come to Christianity and thinking, well, it's going to be like that. We're going to play it backwards. We're going to get all these things back, and life's going to be great. It's going to be hunky-dory, and, you know, life's going to be easier. But not necessarily. Not necessarily. If it just add Jesus, no. We can face the same root issue that they faced as well. You followed Christ, but your kids didn't quite turn out the way you envisioned. And you're feeling a little disillusioned with Christ and the job he's done. Or your ministry. You know, you poured your heart and soul into it. It didn't work out like you thought. In fact, it blew up in your face. You poured your life into people, and instead of appreciating you, they turned around and bit your hand, and they bit you hard. And sometimes that can happen. And we start to look at Jesus and thinking, I don't know if he's as sufficient as I once trusted. Maybe for some of you, it's just by becoming a Christian, that brought problems in your family. And you felt it over the holidays in particular. You went home and it's not like it used to be. In fact, it's kind of painful and difficult. You don't even know what you're going to talk about sometimes. For others of you, being a believer means your livelihood is threatened on a daily basis. Because if you start taking biblical stances at your job, you might lose that job. Or you realize that your life is bigger than merely your job, and so now you're not going to put in 80 hours a week, and your livelihood's threatened because you're not going to be as competitive as the next guy over here who's younger and who's willing to put 80 or 90. And you've said, my life is higher than merely my work. And now you're threatened. Some of them were discouraged. Some of you face the same kind of discouragement. That faith, you know, it isn't plug and play. I just do this and out pops this. Doesn't work that way. It's not predictable and it's not always safe. So the temptation, check out. Go through the motions. Just come to church on Sunday. Don't meet anybody. Don't do anything. Don't say anything and get out. And maybe feel safe. And so their faith was flagging, and for some of you, your faith might be flagging as well, and you're not persevering. And based on that, we actually have a lot in common with these people. We're tempted to believe that Jesus is not enough and maybe start to give up. My sister, she sells this stuff on the side. You know, it's like her own private business, and she's very balanced about it, I'm happy to say. It's a company called Plexus, like energy drinks or something. But she talked about going to a conference one time. She got on the elevator, and you know, all these people that sell Plexus are there, and this person comes on the elevator, and they're wearing a T-shirt, a big pink T-shirt, and it says, "All I need is Jesus and my Plexus." And a lot of times, that's what we do. We say, "All I need is Jesus and..." And here's my expectations. And as a result, what happens? We start to look for answers and solutions from other places. We start to go back to some other things. Instead of going to God's Word to hear from Him, we're starting to get a little bit more out of the talk show or the radio show. That's really our source of authority. Or, you know, you got your questions about your business, so you go into all the business books, and there's a place for that. There's a lot to be learned from those, but they can't be the ultimate guide for your life and your authority. You got to compare that to what the scriptures say. For others of you, it's blogs. That's the first place you go to when you're seeking counsel, you're seeking help, you're seeking direction. You're going to go to that blog and try to find some form of chicken soup for the soul in and through what you may discover there. Or Facebook, you know, hey, everyone else is doing it, so it must be okay for me. So therefore, you know, I feel good and I'm okay. And you can kind of advance in life that way. Or others of you, it looks like this. You're trying to force God's hand to like and accept you. And the way you're going to do it is you're going to try to do everything He says so that He has to do that with you. He has to receive you. And that not only is exhausting, it's deceptive. Because here's what ultimately happens. You wind up handling the law like you do someone who's running away from a bear. I don't have to be the fastest. I just got to be faster than you. And I can get away, right? And that's what you start doing with the law. It isn't that I got to meet the demands of the law. I just got to be better than you. But the reality is, you're not perfect. Why would you go back to that when you have the one who is perfect? We can't lose sight of the one sovereign authority who is the image and the essence of God, the very full and perfect revelation of God, who has all honor. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what our eyes, our attention, our focus, we want it to be on. That's what we want. This past week, I had a chance to sit down with Tim Murphy. Many of you know Tim. He's one of the elders in our church. And Tim and I are talking, and he was kind of throwing some questions out at me. Very good questions. Very introspective one. But here's the one he said. He said, "Which one of these do you find the hardest? Consider the Great Commission. Which one is the hardest? Is it go therefore and make disciples? Or is it baptizing them, which means your evangelism? Or is it teaching them to obey all that I've commanded?" And then he threw this one up and he says, "Or this one that we all forget. Lo, I am with you always." Which one of those is hardest for you? And I have not stopped thinking about that question ever since he asked it. That is an excellent question. And you know what I think? I think the answer for most people is the fourth one. In fact, all the others are dependent on the fourth one, that really believing that Jesus is with us always, and on top of that, that he is who he says he is. And we're not always sure about that. And as a result, we kind of go back to some of these other things that we've placed our trust in. And we can't forget. Our eyes have to be on him. There's an ancient tale of a ruler, Cyrus. You remember Cyrus, the great conqueror? And as he went forth conquering lands, he conquered this one in particular. And in doing so, he had the prince of that land brought before him. And the prince came, and he had his wife next to him, and he had his children around him as well. And as Cyrus looked at him, he kind of sized this prince up, you know, knowing, okay, this guy's in my complete and total command and control. I can do whatever I want with this guy. And so he stopped and he looked at that prince for a minute and he said, "What would you give in exchange for your life?" And the prince said, "In exchange for my life, I'd give up to half my kingdom." Cyrus thought about that for a minute. He said, "Well, what would you give in exchange for the lives of your children around you?" And he said, "Oh, for my children? For their lives, I would give all of my kingdom." Cyrus stopped and he looked at the man, the prince's wife, and he said, "And what would you give in exchange for your wife?" And the prince looked up, and in just the passion in his eyes, he said, "In exchange for the life of my wife, I would give my very own life." Cyrus nodded, and he was moved by that. And he said, "Here's what I will do with you. I'm going to give you your freedom. And I'm going to give you a constant guard to see you protected, and you can go anywhere you want throughout this land and move freely." Well, the prince turned with his wife and his children, and he left. And he also was moved. He was moved by Cyrus's decree. He was in his hand. He could have been crushed. But he had been rescued. And he turned and he looked to his wife, and just sort of as a means of expressing some sort of admiration for Cyrus, he says, "That Cyrus, wasn't he such a handsome fellow?" And his wife looked at him and said, "I would have no idea, because I never took my eyes off of you." Ladies and gentlemen, you and I have a groom who is more than we could possibly imagine, and he has given his very life for you and I. And you know what that means? All we need do is keep our eyes on him. We watch him. Jesus is the dreamliner, the jet that's going to carry you not only to your destination of salvation, but he's going to carry you still to maturity and faith in him, and he will see to it that what God has started in you will be finished as well. He's infinitely qualified to reveal God and carry you and I to the destination of maturity in him. There's an old hymn, great line, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace."